our topic at hand. One of the things I want to bring out is something in the Magna Carta, which we talked about last week, but I didn't highlight this part of it. The good King John had a very high view of himself, because in his first paragraph after the greeting, he says this: "First, that we have granted to God, and by this present chapter have confirmed for us and our heirs in perpetuity, that the English church shall be free." That's a little bit of a assumption about where freedom comes from that I don't agree with. The king does not tell God that God can have his church be free. And yet that's the prevailing thought of the day. And remember that the Magna Carta was the first written document that began to put out a framework for government. And it became a very important part of our own government, which we'll see when we get to that.
Story?
What's that?
Just the same King John with Robin Hood story? Is it the same time period?
It's possible. I don't know that for a fact. I'm sure there were several King Johns.
Brother Richard the Lion.
I would guess that the Magna Carta was before that King John. Wanted to talk about the Mayflower Compact just a little bit, because I think it's such an important document in the formation of our country. I don't know how many of you are aware of the New York Times effort to destroy our history, but they've started a project called the 1619 Project. And what they're arguing is that our country was really founded in 1619. Yes. What's that?
President Trump has openly come against that.
Yes. Anybody with any common sense would come against that.
He said no. Schools that teach this will not receive federal money.
Right, exactly.
And he has opposed it with more than just words.
Exactly. Well, I want to go to the Mayflower Compact, because this is something that flies directly in the face of what the 1619 Project is all about. There on the Mayflower, there started out to be about 109 passengers. 40 of those were believers, and the rest were at least not part of the same separatist group as the Pilgrims were. They may have been believers, but they weren't part of the same group. And they had originally set sail for Jamestown, which is where their suppliers had thought they were going. The travel costs were paid for by a bunch of London merchants. So they were not sailing under the authority of the king. They were sailing because these merchants stepped up and said, "We'll buy everything you need, in exchange for which you need to start sending your crops over to us." Well, the wind blew them about 300 or 400 miles off course, and they ended up at what's now Plymouth, Massachusetts. And they recognized that since they were not going to be at Jamestown, where there was a system of government, that they should have something that they agreed upon, so that they would have a framework for setting up future governments. And this is very short, surprisingly, but this is what they said: "In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord, King James, by the grace of God, of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King, Defender of the Faith, etc. Having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, in honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these presents solemnly and mutually, in the presence of God and of one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better understanding and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, to glorify God, and by the virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, under which we promise all due submission and obedience. In witness thereof, we have hereinafter subscribed our names at Cape Cod, the 11th of November, in the year of the reign of our sovereign Lord, King James of England, France, and Ireland, the 18th, and of Scotland, the 54th, in the year 1620. So they recognized that they had a purpose for coming to this country, and that purpose was to glorify God and advance the Christian faith. It didn't need a great big voluminous document or anything else. It simply is this little one paragraph agreement that they signed and pledged to follow. And so that was the way they set up their form of government for the first X number of years. And they experimented with a number of different economic systems. They basically were socialists in the first year, and half of them starved to death, and so they decided maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so they became capitalists. But they still had the form of governance that was set forth in the Mayflower Compact. And there were several attempts over the years to bring something more permanent into effect. But the king was always in opposition to just about everything they tried to do. Now, interestingly enough, they had sworn allegiance to the King of England. And they would remain true to that throughout the next 100 years or so. In the meantime, though, there were all kinds of things going on. France and England were populating the North American continent slowly but surely, starting from the east and working its way to the west. The King of England granted lands in bands all the way from coast to coast. So the Virginia colony had a band that went straight across the United States to the Pacific Ocean. Well, France is up messing around in Newfoundland, and Spain was operating down in Florida and controlled all of Florida. And Spain and France were fighting against the English, and the English were kind of coming out on the short end of the stick for a good part of time because they hadn't yet built up an army or a navy. And France was very aggressive in trying to take over land that the king had already given to the inhabitants of Jamestown and the other settlements up and down the coast. And so that starts leading to conflict between France and Great Britain. And interestingly enough, it ended in something called the French and Indian War. And I thought, well, that's kind of a strange thing to bring into this discussion. But for some reason, what it was is the British against the French and the Indians. And this was a war that lasted for 7 years. Actually, it lasted for 9 years, but the primary war was only 7 years. It determined control of the vast colonial territory of North America. There had been three previous phases to try and settle this. There was a war in 1689 to 97, Queen Anne's War from 1702 to 1713, King George's War from 1744 to 1748. So there was a lot of fighting going on. And still the people in the descendants of the Mayflower and other settlements remain loyal to the king. And the battles over control lasted for about 60 years. And they were fighting over who had claim to the lands in the Great Mississippi Basin. So one of the French explorers had gone all the way down the Mississippi to what now is New Orleans. And so they said, well, we explored it first. That's what France said. So we're entitled to it. But the king had already granted that land to the people in Massachusetts. And so the people in Massachusetts were looking to the king to come and fight the battle for them because they had no army. And so that kind of set up the French and Indian War, which ended up as a big seesaw battle. For about 4 years, the French were just dominating everything. The British won one battle. And the French, they took control of all the forts. They booted the English out of major parts of the land that they had. And it began to look pretty bleak for our side, I guess. But things started to happen in Europe that kind of changed everything around. Great Britain had a very small navy and a very small army, and they were having trouble getting their cargo across the ocean either direction because the French and the Dutch and everybody else had bigger navies. So England started putting together a navy, and over just a very short period of time, they were able to completely wipe out the French navy. And so they became the stronger of the two. Trying to keep us within our time frame here. The number of battles that the French won is a full page long, just describing the battles. Because they were still dominant on the ground over here. And the British were trying to force the Americans to go into battle for them. And the Americans weren't taking real kindly to that. I was going to read a quote that kind of exemplifies the way the British looked at it. Basically, what it said, the Prime Minister of England at that time said to the king, "Let the Americans fight Americans. We're not going to get involved in it." And the reason I thought that was such an interesting comment is because here is the King of England agreeing with the Prime Minister that these were Americans in North America, not British subjects. Okay? So they wanted to continue to control the people, but they didn't want them to be considered British subjects. And that's kind of the prevailing attitude that was taking place during that whole period of the French and Indian War and all the way up to the Declaration of Independence, that Great Britain had by now, as I talked about last week, formed a parliament. They had representatives of the royalty in the parliament. They had granted the citizens of Great Britain citizenship so that they were entitled to certain rights and privileges, but they would not acknowledge that the people in North America were entitled to citizenship. And that's why it was important to point out that it was a bunch of merchants in London that paid for the Mayflower to come over, not the King of England. Yes.
Well, at the time,
you have to speak loudly.
They were shipping over. They were emptying their jails. The people that they sent here weren't necessarily the better quality whatever.
Right.
And that's how they looked on it. This was a nation of criminals. And on top of that, they had to keep sending more because the Indians kept killing them.
Right.
I mean, there was massive Indian wars up and down the coast. They'd wipe them out, they'd send more, they'd wipe them out. The Indians didn't just follow what was going on between
right.
France and Great Britain. They were killing both sides at the impunity.
But interestingly enough, Randy, if you contrast America with Australia, there was one essential difference between those two countries. We had, as I showed you in the Mayflower Compact,
exactly.
A religious purpose for why we were here. And they were shipping even more criminals to Australia, and Australia didn't have that same religious purpose behind them. So, yes, Albert.
As far as sending criminals over here.
As far as what?
Sending criminals over here?
Yeah.
My forebears came here as Reformed Dutch, or excuse me, Reformed Swiss. And they held beliefs contrary to that of their English church. So they might have been considered the dregs, but they were also reformed.
Well, the...
But they had a fort that, or they dwelt in a fort that was eventually overcome by the Indians, the Delaware, the Shawnee, and
right.
The scalp.
I have a question.
Use their scalps as...
Yes.
When you say criminal, what kind of criminal are you talking about? Because they didn't obey the king.
We're talking about people that were in prison for committing crimes.
Were the separatists in prison?
What?
Yes, they were. Were the separatists in prison?
Some were. The ones on the Mayflower were not, because they had migrated out of England into Holland. And they spent 12 years in Holland. And Holland is kind of a difficult place to break into because... they had a royalty class of their own, so the separatists wound up working whatever kind of manual jobs they could find, and they were basically ending up starving at the end of the 12-year period.
So the separatists, were they considered criminals in the king as well?
What's that?
The separatists would have been considered criminals as well to the king?
I don't know that they necessarily were. They were criminals in the sense that the king was the head of the Church of England.
It's more theological than civil, right?
What?
Like the separatists, they would have been considered criminals because they didn't agree with the king.
Well, they didn't agree with him on what the church should be. Remember that between the Magna Carta and 1620 had been this minor little event called the Reformation. And the Reformation is what we spring from. But the Church of England really, all they did was they took the Roman Catholic worship style, and they just superimposed it on themselves. And King George, as you may recall, wanted to divorce his wife, and the Catholic Church wouldn't allow it, so he kicked the Catholic Church out of Great Britain, made himself the head of the Catholic Church, or the Roman Church at that time. The Church of England at that time. And yet it was still basically Roman Catholicism. So out of that Reformation came people that didn't agree with the Roman Catholics. And so to that extent, they were disagreeing with the King of England. And those that escaped to Holland were spared from being called criminals. That's why they were able to migrate on their own. The ones that stayed behind weren't always so lucky, but I didn't do a lot of study on that because
many of the Separatists that were in England, their leaders were thrown into the dungeons. And back then, to be thrown into the dungeon was almost a death sentence. And so that's one reason they had to get out of there, because their leaders were being killed. So it was because of their religious belief that they left and went to Holland.
Yeah, and I don't think those are the kinds of criminals that were being sent over to get rid of them.
Remember, some of those criminals were in prison and happy never used.
Yeah.
Doing nothing more serious than stealing a loaf of bread because they were starving.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it was not a country that you would have wanted to live in, to say the least. I want to scoot on down here for a ways. The war really turned because of a string of French victories. And the army and the navy of Great Britain was in a state of disarray. And there was a man by the name of William Pitt, who had been a formidable British statesman, but had been sidelined by his political enemies. He was able to take control of the British army at a point where they were in disarray. And he recognized that while the British were fighting against the French and the Indians in America and against the French in Europe, that the most important thing to do is to put all of his efforts into America, because he realized that that's where all of their future wealth was going to come from, was from America. And so he dedicated himself to the American conflict and let the European conflict take its own path. So he had the British Navy at this point built up to the strongest in the world and was able to clear the seas. That stopped France from being able to bring their own food over to feed their own troops. And it was because of that, the blockade of the whole eastern coast by British ships, that the battle began to turn and England ultimately was able to vanquish France and the Indians. Now, at the same time, the Germans were involved in their own problems, and they ultimately had to withdraw from Florida, but they hung on to Louisiana, basically, and used it to bargain for some things that they really wanted and turned it over to the French. And that's how New Orleans came to be basically a French-speaking area. And the French remained in control of Canada, or most of Canada. The British had kind of the coastal areas of Canada taken on by this time. But that kind of sets the scene then for what we want to talk about in terms of what happens in our country and what were the things that were taking place that led to our Declaration of Independence. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about that, and then we'll go into more detail about it next week and the week after. We talk about the Declaration of Independence being July 4, 1776, but the battle between the colonists and Great Britain had really begun with the Battle of Concord in 1775. So they were already shooting at one another. And you really can't blame them, because we're going to see a little bit more in the latter part of this class. But the king was not treating the American colonists in a fair-handed manner. And there's about 90-some things that the king was doing that are enumerated in the Declaration of Independence as a basis for that. But the background behind that is what's really interesting to me. The fact that the king and the prime minister had basically disowned the colonists by saying, let the Americans fight the Americans, set the tone for what was going to take place over the next couple of years. I want to skip down here to some of the events that were taking place. In May of 1775, the Second Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia, where John Hanson was elected President of the United States and Congress assembled. I bet you didn't know there was a president before George Washington. They issued a petition for redress of grievances and sent it to the king by the First Continental Congress, and he had refused to answer that. So they had a sort of a Declaration of Independence in 1774, and the king said, nah, I'm not going to pay any attention to it. So once again, the colonists are feeling like, hey, we don't know what we are. We've pledged allegiance to the king, but the king won't pledge allegiance to us. What are we? So in June of 75, Congress established its own Continental Army. They established a national monetary currency and a post office to serve the United Colonists. August of 75, King George declared his American subjects to be engaged in open and avowed rebellion against the crown. The English Parliament passed the American Prohibitory Act, declaring all American seagoing vessels and their cargo the property of England. So they seized all of the ships and all of the products of the colonies, once again denying them the privileges and rights of citizenship. January of 1776, colonists by the thousands buy copies of Thomas Paine's Common Sense, stating the cause of American independence. There were a number of authors in the Age of Enlightenment that wrote about forms of government and rights of free men and all of those issues. And the most prominent of those was Thomas Paine. And he was the one that really inspired the drive to become their own country. Because he said, you have a right to be free. And that's where that and some of these other authors were the ones that really began to talk about the natural rights or the God-given rights. And that really inspired a lot of the colonists. In March of 1776, Congress passed the Privateering Resolution, allowing colonists to arm vessels in order to cruise on the enemies of the United Colonies. So a reaction to the king saying, I'm seizing all of your ships. Our Congress said, no, you're not. And that starts to build up the tensions even more. April of 1776, American seaports were open to trade and cargo from other nations for the first time. So another step away from the king by saying, we're not going to exclusively trade with England. We're going to trade with whoever we want to trade with. Germany, in May of 76, through a treaty negotiated with King George, agrees to hire mercenary soldiers to help put down any potential uprising by the American colonists. So the King of England didn't have enough resources on his own, so he hired through Germany mercenaries to come over and fight the wars. May of 1776, Congress passes the resolution for the formation of local governments, allowing colonists to establish their own local governments. Eight colonies agreed to support American independence. So this is the first formalization of the desire to be separate from England. And in reality, they already were separate because England was saying, you're not citizens. So it's kind of a natural cause of events here that is going to take place. June 7th of 1776, Richard Henley Lee, Virginia's delegate to the Continental Congress, presents the Lee Resurrection, reading in part, resolved that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. You'll recognize that language as part of the Declaration. June 11, 1776, Congress postpones consideration of the Lee Resolution and appoints the Committee of Five to draft a final statement declaring the case for America's independence. The Committee of Five is composed of John Adams of Massachusetts, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Robert Livingston of New York, and Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. July 2nd, 1776, by the votes of 12 of the 13 colonies, with New York not voting, Congress adopts the Lee Resolutions and begins consideration of the Declaration of Independence written by the Committee of Five. July 4th, late in the afternoon, church bells ring out over Philadelphia, heralding the final adoption of the Declaration of Independence. August 2nd, delegates of the Continental Congress sign the clearly printed or engrossed version of the Declaration. So they took it to a printer and they had it printed up. Today, faded but still legible, the Declaration of Independence, along with the Constitution and Bill of Rights, is enshrined for public display on the rotunda of the National Archives and Records Building in Washington, D.C. Priceless documents are stored in an underground vault at night and are constantly monitored for any degradation of their condition. How many of you have been to the exhibit and seen the... So a few of us have. Kind of makes you just stand there and feel tiny and unimportant. I want to talk about the root causes of the American Revolution. No single event caused the revolution. Instead, a series of events that led to the war. Essentially, it began as a disagreement over the way Great Britain governed the colonies and the way the colonies thought they should be treated. Americans felt they deserved all rights of Englishmen. The British, on the other hand, thought that the colonies were created to be used in ways that best suited the Crown and Parliament. This conflict is embodied in the rallying cry of the American Revolution, no taxation without representation. So, just as I pointed out earlier, the king was saying, I'm going to use you and abuse you and give you no rights. And the colonists said, if you're going to tax us, you got to let us be represented in government, and you can't tax us differently than you're taxing your own citizens. And of course, the king said, no, the war was to protect you. You got to pay for it. So all of a sudden, this burden of a 9-year war between Great Britain and France was being thrust upon the colonists. Another thing that led to it is Americans' independent way of thinking. In order to understand what led to the rebellion, it's important to look at the mindset of the founding fathers. It should also be noted that this mindset was not that of the majority of colonists. There were no pollsters during the American Revolution, but it's safe to say it politically rose and fell over the course of the war. Historian Robert Calhoun estimated that only about 40 or 50% of the free population supported the revolution, while about 15 to 20% of the free white males remained loyal to the king. The 18th century is known historically as the Age of Enlightenment. It was a period when thinkers, philosophers, statesmen, and artists began to question the politics of government, the role of the church, and other fundamental and ethical questions of society as a whole. The period was also known as the Age of Reason, and many colonists followed this new way of thinking. Another one that had a major influence was John Locke. In Locke's writings, it struck a particularly strong chord with the colonists. His book helped to raise questions about the rights of the governed, the overreach of the British government. They spurred the Republican ideology that stood up in opposition to those viewed as tyrants. Men such as Benjamin Franklin and John Adams were also influenced by the teachings of the Puritans and the Presbyterians. These teachings included such new radical ideas as the principle that all men are created equal, and that the belief that the king has no divine rights. Together, these innovative ways of thinking led many in this era to consider it their duty to rebel against the laws they viewed as unjust. So those are some of the things that led to the mindset of revolution. Some other factors, the geography of the colonies also contributed to the revolution. Their distance from Great Britain naturally created a sense of independence that was hard to overcome. Those willing to colonize the New World generally had a strong independent streak with a profound desire for new opportunities and more freedom. There were some things that are kind of incidental to it, like the king saying, you can't go any further west than this line. That's as far as you can go, and that way he had control of this little section of the coastline, he thought. Another thing that influenced it was the existence of colonial legislatures. It meant that colonies were in many ways independent of the crown. Well, you can imagine if it took the Mayflower 66 days to cross the Atlantic, it took a long time for a word to get from America to England and then the king to act on it and get the word back over here. So you got 4, 5, 6 months have passed. So even the king recognized there needed to be some forms of government. And with his approval, local governments were established.
He appointed governors.
What?
He appointed governors and viceroys.
That's part of it. But part of it, though, were elected leaders in the colonies. The governors may have been appointed, but the legislatures were not appointed.
Right, but the crown's government
was not elected by the government.
Oh, no. The Crown's government wasn't elected by anybody.
Government.
Yeah.
And they were not very nice people. Most.
Right. Same time that all this was happening in the colonies, Great Britain was having huge economic problems because they had spent basically all of their money on fighting the French. And they were near bankruptcy, and France was bankrupt. And so that war just essentially took the two great world powers at the time and put them near bankruptcy. And the king said, well, the only way I can get out of this is if I treat the colonies as my slaves, don't give them any rights, and force them to turn over their products to the king. What?
He just needed a central bank.
Yeah, he needed a central bank, all right.
He needed money for it.
What he needed was a piggy bank where he could put what little he had in it and let it sit. I'm going to skip that. We're about done here, so. One of the problems that was really rearing its head was the corruption of the British government. And they were doing all kinds of things that were corrupt. And a big part of it was the criminal justice system. How many of you have heard of the Boston Massacre? The British soldiers shot and killed six people in Boston. And the soldiers were arrested and put on trial. But the British government decided they didn't want their citizens being tried by our non-citizens. So they said, henceforth, any of my officers that get arrested are going to be tried in England, not in the United States. And, of course, the king agreed to pay the transportation of the witnesses from America back to England and back, but they had to give up their jobs and they had no income, and so very few were ever willing to do that. And so now you got all these British officers that are committing heinous crimes in America and being tried in Great Britain. So those were all the things that led to the events of the American Revolution. I didn't go into a lot of detail because you can understand what was happening that was so grievous to the colonies. I mean, they were being taxed more than the British citizens were. The king denied them their citizenship rights. He took away their right to try criminals for crimes committed in America and took it back over to Great Britain. And we'll see in the Declaration of Independence some of the other things that were going on. And it was heinous. I can't hear you.
The people had a hard life. They worked hard.
Yes.
And just living was difficult. And it created a type of people that were totally independent.
Yeah.
That's,
I mean, when you just pack up and leave your home and come over here and say, I'm going to carve a livelihood out of the wilderness, you got to be a different kind of person than the person that stays in London and lives the life of luxury. So we have an independent spirit that Great Britain lacked. Now there's one other thing, and I'm going to delay it till next time. It's called the Intolerable Acts. The king, or his prime minister, passed five different laws that were very, very bad laws. And that's what ultimately led to the Declaration of Independence. And we'll cover that next time. You're dismissed.